Hi, I'm Francis Hellier, and welcome to my podcast, Metaverse. Dedicated to the emerging world of the metaverse, this podcast aims to demystify and unpack the possibilities of the digital future just dawning over the horizon. In each episode, I talk to leaders in this growing space who are forging this new reality. From innovators in AR and VR, to futurists in crypto and space travel, and forecasters in business and tech. Together we'll ask the question, what's next? Today I'm joined by Kenan Sala, an innovator and investor on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list, who was inspired by business podcasts and movies like The Social Network to try and become a successful CEO by 21. He achieved it at 19. While still a student at the University of Pennsylvania, he co-founded a startup that allowed rideshare drivers to earn extra income through digital advertising. After less than a year, that business, Halo Cars, was acquired by Lyft, where Kenan now runs the rideshare giant's advertising division as head of product at Lyft Media. In the 2022 South by Southwest Festival, he was a speaker on the future of no-code tech and how no-code has changed the tech industry by showing how companies can grow and scale without launching a single line of code. Kenan, it's great to have you on the show.
Hi, Francis. Thank you. That was a great introduction. I can tell you've done your research.
My pleasure. Now, here at Metaverse, we like to inspire listeners to reach for their dreams, and you've certainly achieved that. Tell us how movies like The Social Network and other inspiring content help shape your journey.
I gave an interview on this. There was an article someone wrote about in a magazine where they were asking about what influenced some young entrepreneurs, and I mentioned that movie. And I think you saw that article probably. What I would say is, for me personally, it was actually a very influential film. And a lot of people that I talk to who are my age will say the same thing, because it came out right around when I was entering high school. So right around when I was starting to think about careers in a serious way. And I think entertainment and media has always been very influential on young generations. And it shows people, for a lot of people in their young, movies are how they learn about the world and how they envision themselves. They envision what's possible, and some of their ambitions come from what they see in movies. So this was one of the first films that idolized or kind of glorified entrepreneurs, and especially tech entrepreneurs, young tech entrepreneurs, maybe ever. I don't know of any film before that that glorified and made a hero out of the young tech entrepreneur. That's why it was very influential to me. I mean, I viewed it as, I related to the characters in the film. I could see myself being those people. The movie was also glorified the entire being a tech entrepreneur. And that's what made me start thinking about entrepreneurship very seriously. So in middle school and high school, I would tell people I wanted to be a CEO. And that was mostly from that movie. I didn't really know what a CEO was until that movie. And that's what started my whole curiosity. And then why I eventually ended up pursuing that career path. And that all started there. That was a seed.
Now, you're the one giving advice these days. So what's your key recommendation to entrepreneurs who want to build systems and see them scale?
I would say that there's a lot of things. It depends on what their stage is. The number one advice I tell people is to get started. And I think a lot of people, for example, their first instinct when they want to build something or they want to create a company is, I need to raise money. And once I raise money, then I'll have a company and then I can hire all these people. And I think it's a backwards way to think about company building. I think the way to think about building a company or building anything is you should start building it yourself. And then once you've built something that has any traction or deserves to be funded, then you should go get funding for it. So the order should not be the reverse. So I hear people say, I need to raise money to hire people to build it. And I think that's wrong. You should build it yourself or find a co-founder or a team who's willing to build it with you. And then if it's successful, then you should go seek out funding, and then you should expand if you choose to, or don't. If you don't need funding, then you don't need to do that at all. But I frequently see people who can't build who want to be entrepreneurs. And I think that that's incompatible. You need to learn how to build whatever product you're envisioning, or at least build enough of the part of the business such that you can find somebody who complements you and does the other side. But there's no room for just ideas, people. There's a lot of ideas, people. Like, I have great ideas, but I can't implement. And I think I would say there's no room for that. There's no value in just being an ideas guy. You need to be able to build your ideas in order for them to have value.
Now, explain your belief in no-code tech, and how is it possible to succeed in the tech industry without writing any code whatsoever?
So the previous point I made is that you can't just be an ideas person. You need to be able to build things. And the way that you can build things, a lot of people want to create software startups or tech startups in some way. And if you want to build a tech startup, you need to be able to create software. Creating software right now, or you know, at least in the past, involved writing code. You needed to learn a programming language. You needed to understand how to develop systems using these languages, which was relatively hard. They were specific languages. It was specific knowledge. If you didn't know how to do it, it's not something that you could pick up very quickly. You could spend time and learn it, but it probably would take you, I don't know, 3 to 6 months at least before you could be even remotely proficient. And even if after those 6 months, you probably couldn't build anything production, but you could just start to be competent. So if you wanted to learn how to build software before, let's say with the programming languages, it was very high barrier to entry. No code is another way to build software that is much lower barrier to entry. It's basically abstracting away a programming languages to some sort of drag and drop or some sort of visual interface that is easier for people to learn and understand, but you can still create production level software. And the way that works is that these no code companies build a platform that basically translates the visual interface into code for you. So you don't have to write code. You just operate at the visual interface level, and then that gets translated into code that then is software that you can use. So now that the no-code platforms are quite good, you can create software without having to learn how to program, which lowers the barrier of entry in order to make software, which in turn lowers the barrier of entry to create products and build companies or anything like this. So that's why I'm a huge believer in no-code. I think it's just, once again, it democratizes access to building software, which is important for anybody who wants to build anything.
Now, as an angel investor, what investment strategies do you follow?
Yeah, I'm not a great, you know, I don't really think of myself as an angel investor or as an investor, really, as a professional investor, at least. My approach has always been, as an angel investor, is that I invest in exceptional people that I know well and that I trust blindly. And that's almost it. So most of the people that I'm investing in are my friends, people I've known for a while, friends of friends, and or people I've been connected to at some time during my career. And then I think they're exceptional, so I back them. I don't, you know, pretend to be a very sophisticated investor, although I think that that's a good strategy for investing. But that's it. That's all I really do. And that's what I've been doing ever since. Once we sold our company, I was looking to reinvest some of that into other founders. And that's how all of this came about. It was all relationships, all opportunistic. Yeah.
How many exceptional friends do you have?
Quite a bit. So there's been about, I don't know how many I've done at this point, maybe 30, 40, I'm not sure. And I would say about half of them are people I know personally who I either went to school with them or I was friends with them or something. So I thought they were exceptional. I believed in them. The other half are friends of friends. So somebody that I know knows this person. I trust that person. And they told me that this person's really strong and the person's an amazing founder. I'm investing and I trust them. And because I trust that person, transitive property, I trust the other person that they're recommending and I invested. So that's once you do friends of friends, obviously the pool opens up quite a bit as well.
Of course. Now, let's go back a bit. Let's go to your origin story. Where did your interest in digital technology come from?
So once again, when I was younger, I was very interested in being an entrepreneur and building products or building companies. And it was clear to me that technology and software was probably the highest leverage or the area of most opportunity to build high quality products and high quality companies. So I don't think for me, it's that I was interested in technology. I think I was interested in building great products, and then technology allows you to do that, or building really interesting services or products, and technology is allows you to do that right now. So that's how I became interested in technology, mostly as a means. So if I want to create really great products, software right now is the best way to do that. It's the highest leverage way to do that. It's the newest way. So it's kind of a byproduct of what I wanted to achieve. You need a technology in order to do that.
Now, what prompted the idea for Halo cars and the hyper-targeted ads on top of the cars?
The idea for Halo came from me and my co-founders had some experience in advertising, in digital advertising, from internships. And one of my co-founders worked at Google for a while, working in ads for a few years. And the idea was simply that we thought online advertising, digital advertising, had gotten extremely advanced in their targeting, using data, using all sorts of technology and automation, in order to very efficiently target ads. We were comparing that to what's called the outdoor advertising world. They call it out of home, OOH for short. And the outdoor advertising world did not have any advancement or any technology or any data that was being used. So the idea simply was, we should take what's made online ads extremely advanced and extremely efficient, take the same technology and the same data, or at least some parts of it, and apply that to the outdoor advertising world. And we thought by doing that, we can make the outdoor advertising products a lot better. And so that was it. For example, outdoor advertising products, most of them are static. They're not actually digital. So you can see billboards, they're static billboards, paper. On taxis, it's mostly static. A lot of the outdoor advertising world is still static. So one huge step forward is if you just digitize. If you make that digital, you unlock so many things. You no longer have to send somebody to change it every 4 weeks. You can change it over the air at any time. You can now do things. You could run a campaign for just like an hour, and that would be feasible. If you wanted to run a static campaign for an hour, the cost would be too much. You'd have to print it, send somebody to put it up, send somebody to take it down. All that would be so expensive that it makes short time frame advertising campaigns unfeasible. So one huge innovation was just digitizing. And we had digitized the taxi top or rooftop advertising space. The other area of innovation that we saw was targeting based off of data. So if you know the mobile device IDs of people around the cars or people in the cars, you can understand their preferences, and then you can target the ads based off of who they are. Obviously with static, you can't do that at all because static cannot change. So you can't do any sort of targeting. Digital, you can do that. So those were the two axes that we saw that outdoor advertising could become 10x better. And that's how we got the idea. So we saw this is a great opportunity, and that's why we got started.
Now, can we deep dive a little bit into the tech? How does that actually work?
So the digital portion there is pretty straightforward. These are smart digital screens. So think of them as almost like mini phones in a way, but they have a digital screen, they have a CPU, they have a GPS, they have Wi-Fi, they have LTE, they have 4G, they have internet connection. So what we can do now is these screens, one, they have a connection to the internet, so we can update them at any single point or at any time, and they can update us on where they are. They have GPS, so we know where the screens are, and then they have a chip. So, and they have memory, and they have a CPU, they have all these things. So we can store things there, we can upload, we can send from the unit to our servers, and these are just smart screens. So, and then the LED screens are just LED, normal LED, like you have in TVs and computers and all these other technologies that use LED screens. So that's how it works. These are, you install them on top of the car, and then these are just like IoT smart screens that are connecting to our server, and then we can control them remotely.
Can you give some examples of where campaigns have been particularly successful?
Yeah, a lot of the very targeted campaigns have been extremely successful. So one of the most common types of campaigns that we run is targeted to a store. So in New York, for example, an advertiser says our store is in Soho and we want to advertise to people around the store. So we want, if the car is in Soho, we want to show our advertising and we want to say that our store is whatever, a few blocks away. And those types of campaigns are very effective because they're so well targeted. And the other layer of targeting, so that's location targeting. Another layer of targeting that works very well is day and time targeting. So people say, I want to do it only during store hours, only at night, only in the mornings, or whatever is relevant for your product or business. And if you combine that with location, now they become extremely well targeted. So you're only showing ads at the location, at the time that is relevant for you. And when you do that, the ad spend is so much more efficient. You're not wasting impressions and times or areas that are not relevant for you. And those campaigns have worked very well. So those campaigns work really well. The other types of campaigns that work very well is just blanket. We want to just control the entire, all of Manhattan or all of New York in for a week or a month. We just want to completely dominate it. We want to buy out every single screen. And when you walk in New York, we want to see you everywhere. So we have some advertisers that take that approach. They take this just like, we want to blanket and just dominate a certain area. And we want us to be everywhere for a shorter period of time. So it's like, very, very targeted types of advertising, but not location or time targeted. So they're not saying I want it in a certain area or not, but I want it at a certain time. I want everything within this time frame. And that does work very well. We have some advertisers that take that approach and that works well for them. And then the flip, what I just described, is the opposite. It's we want to do a longer campaign, but extremely targeted in where and when we show it. Both of those have worked. They work very well for us. I can think of 5 or 6 advertisers that have tried each of those types of strategies, and they've been successful for them in their own ways.
Okay. Now, how did you find your first supplier, and how did you actually balance that business with your college studies?
Our first supplier, the other thing that's also I want to clarify is that when we started a company, we didn't wake up one day and say, hey, we're starting a company. We had this idea, and then we started to build this idea and test it out. It was that simple to start. It wasn't a company right away. It was an idea, and then we tested that idea. We got a product, we built a prototype, and then we put it on one driver, and that was our test. So we did this all very iteratively. So our first hardware was just off the shelf. We bought it from supplier on Alibaba. First three, four, or five of them were like that. Really bad hardware, really bad. We paid a lot for them. They looked bad. It was just, they were really bad, but that's how we got started. It was just cheap, fastest way for us to get started. And it worked fantastic for us prototyping and learning and testing out the business. And then after that, we went to China. Once we had done it with one or five and these tests were working and we were confident that this could be a business, then we raised money. Then we went to China and we did a full supplier evaluation. We met with all the suppliers. We negotiated. We saw their manufacturing facilities. We talked about customizations. We designed our hardware and we built it with them. And that was a more production grade, higher quality unit and a similar model to what we're using today. But that was maybe the fifth iteration we had. And that was only after we had already proved that the business, we had already proved that we had confidence in the business before we did all of that work and invested in making really great hardware. That's how we did it. Just old fashioned, go to China, meet with all the suppliers and do evaluations on the floor.
So how do you see digital advertising technologies developing over the next 10, 15 years?
One thing is that everything is going to be digital. So even today, not everything is digital. So when you go outdoors, most of the outdoor advertising assets are still static. I don't know the exact percentage, but I would say it's still probably 80-20. 80% of them are static, 20% are digital. So over time, over the next 15 years, this digital percentage is going to keep increasing. And eventually this will be 100%. I don't know when it's going to be 100%, but this is going to keep increasing for the next 5-10 years until it reaches 100%. Digital is always superior to static in the long run. Maybe in the short run, it can be cheaper to have static or advantageous for some reasons, but in the long run, the screens and digital technology should get cheaper and cheaper, and eventually it'll make sense. So step one is everything becoming digital. Once everything is digital, everything can talk to each other. So static ads cannot talk to each other. They cannot communicate in any way, and you cannot change what's being shown on them based off of what happened at the other one. So they're kind of dumb in a way. I mean, extremely dumb, actually. They're just literally paper. Once everything goes digital, everything will start talking to each other, which means that the billboard will talk to the subway ad, will talk to the taxi top ad, will talk to the airplane ad, will talk to the, like all the outdoor ads will start to talk together. And you will start tying things together. Like, this person saw this ad on the billboard. Let's also show them it when they get in the subway. And this kind of becomes, it sounds a little bit dystopian, you know, like we're just going to target everything around you as you're walking around. And there's obviously a lot of privacy things to be worked around and to be figured out. But this is how the online advertising world works. When you go to one website, they know you were there. And then you go to the next one, they know what you saw on the previous one. And then they target what you see there based off of what you saw last time. And then if you acted on it, and all the websites, everything in the online advertising world is talking to each other. And that's why Facebook ads are so good. That's why Facebook is was a trillion dollar company before the market did, because they're using all this data to target these ads really well. And that will come to the outdoor advertising world. It's going to take, everything needs to be digital. It's going to take more sort of data sharing for that to happen, but that's where this is going.
Do you think that the digital marketing space will continue to be dominated by players like Google and Facebook, or do you think new players will come along with more inventive ideas, or will they just be acquired by the big giants?
It's a tough question. I mean, if I could answer that question effectively, you know, I would be making bets in the stock market, and there's not many people in the world who can really say what's going to happen there. What I will say is that the internet advertising or just online advertising is about distribution. It's about who has the largest audience, where are people's eyeballs going? And if you have a lot of eyeballs, you have distribution, and then you can put advertising there. So there's a few reasons why Google and Facebook are such big advertisers. One reason is because they have a lot of data about you. When you go to Facebook, you give them all sorts of data based off of your activity, and then they can also map and merge that activity based off with what you do elsewhere on the internet. So they have a lot of first-party data, what you do in the Facebook ecosystem, and then third-party data, what you do on other areas of the internet that are not part of the Facebook ecosystem, but are integrated in. So they have a lot of data, that's number one. But number two is they have a lot of eyeballs. A lot of people are going to Facebook because it's a product that gives them some sort of value. And so they just have a lot of reach. They have huge distribution and they have huge amounts of data. So the question is really about the huge amounts of data. They always are going to have data. So the other question is, how long are they going to keep all of these eyeballs? And this is, how long is Facebook going to be a compelling product? How long is Instagram going to be a compelling product that everybody wants to use? And, you know, how will that evolve over time? I think that it is unlikely that any one of those individual platforms lasts forever. So we've already seen the cycle of the Facebook app. So the Facebook app is now decreasing and shrinking in terms of users. Instagram is growing, but slowing. And you can see the cycle proceeding, where Facebook at one point was very high growth, was where everybody wanted to spend time. And then it kind of flattened. Now it's decreasing. Then Instagram started taking off. Now it's starting to flatten. TikTok took off. So you can see these cycles going. And social apps tend to be very cyclical. There's very few social apps that are generational, that last for multiple generations or even decades. They tend to go in cycles. And I would imagine that Instagram will go through the same cycle. So I don't think in 5 to 10 years, it's likely that Instagram is as popular as it is today. I think in 5 to 10 years, Instagram growth is either slowed or is reversing, like the Facebook app. Can Facebook get another app like Instagram that takes that next thing? I don't know. I'm not sure about that, but I'm 100% sure it's not going to be Instagram. So it's either going to be a new, you know, Meta app, I guess. I don't want to use the word Facebook because Facebook is now, they call the app Facebook, but it's either going to be a new Meta app or some other new company's app that will replace this cycle, but this cycle will continue.
Have you explored advertising in the metaverse yet?
I haven't, no, but I've seen a number of things about it, and I've seen some interesting deals and interesting things about it, but I haven't spent a lot of time in that space yet.
What does the future hold for you, Keenan?
So I work at Lyft right now. I run the media business at Lyft, which has been fantastic, and I'm very much enjoying. So in the short term, we have so much more to grow as a team within Lyft, and we're maybe 10% of the way of where we can go. So I have a lot of things to do here. We have a ton of growth in front of us. After that, who knows? I don't really plan very far in advance as a person. I don't have 5-year or 10-year plans. But so in front of me, we need to grow Lyft Media so much more than it is already. After Lyft Media, I'm not sure. Who knows?
Wonderful. Listen, you've been listening to Metaverse with me, Francis Hellier. Thank you to my guest, Keenan Seller, for a fantastic conversation. Tweet us at Metaverse Pod with any suggestions or feedback. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please do share a link on social media. You can sign up to receive an email when a new episode drops at our website, metaverse.fm.